the headlines. Iran strongly condemns the new sanctions on the country over the recent riots, vowing reciprocal bans against European Union. The Palestinian Authority embraces Australia's decision to reverse the recognition of West Al-Quds as Israel's capital. Plus, the UK Prime Minister Liz Truss makes it clear that she will hang on to power despite apologizing for her mistakes. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Misha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Strong condemnation coming out of Iran following EU sanctions over its response to the riots in the country. The Iranian foreign ministry is now promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities. The ministry spokesman says EU sanctions constitute a violation of international law and are a clear example of meddling in Iran's internal affairs. Nasser Kanani says the EU's decision shows its bias and that it is using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. He added that the EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation in Iran as a major violator of human rights due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh U.S. sanctions on the country. Earlier, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It's an unconstructive act out of miscalculation, based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
Amir Abdollahian's tweet came hour sanctions on Iran for entities. The bans target AIDS police as well as the Basij volunteer forces and of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology has also blacklisted. Some European officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest that followed the death of a young woman. Mahsa Amini died in hospital days after collapsing at a police station in Iran. A forensics investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. Head of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh, says there is a clear difference between rioting and protesting, and no governments in the world can allow rioting during protests.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran is part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate. But no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's life. I mean, we have seen footage of security forces in Iran being kept and then put a light, petrol put on them and put a light. No government, no authority could allow this sort of behavior to be unleashed in their society, because they have the responsibility and indeed the duty to protect people and create security within the society. You know, I could give you over and over history of what is being done in Britain. I mean, for example, the riots in Bradford, the judge orders and said anyone who holds the stone, even if they don't throw it and they drop it on CCTV, should get 5 years imprisonment. Anyone holding a Molotov cocktail, and even if not throwing it and dropping it, should get 8 years imprisonment.
The Palestinian Authority hails Australia's decision after Canberra said it is reversing the previous administration's decision to recognize West Al-Quds as the Israeli capital. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has described the turnaround as a correction of a mistake previously made by Canberra. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong announced a reversal of the 2018 decision just a few hours ago. Wong said only talks between Israelis and Palestinians should determine the status of Al-Quds. Canberra's announcement has angered Israel. The regime's premier has strongly criticized the move. The regime has also summoned the Australian ambassador to lodge a protest. The former Australian government took the step to Al-Quds after similar moves by the U.S. and few other Western countries. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the United Nations to hold Israel accountable for its deadly aggression against the people in the occupied West Bank. The human rights also urged the UN to break the Israeli siege on Palestinians and the refugee camps. It also called on the regime's blockade, a collective punishment for hundreds of thousands of defenseless Palestinians in a blatant violation of international law. The resistance group said the UN should assume responsibility to criminalize the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. The regime has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 120 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks this year so far. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says the world has turned a blind eye to Israeli crimes against Palestinians for decades.
For more than seven decades, the international community has turned a blind eye to Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Today, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas called on the United Nations to exert pressure on the Israeli regime to lift the blockade and closures of refugee camps and towns in the occupied West Bank that has placed hundreds of thousands of civilians under the draconian measures by the Israeli regime. I believe Hamas's move to call on the United Nations to interfere is to show that the Palestinian resistance faction is flexible regarding the situation.
U.S. officials have not been invited to a Saudi investment conference planned for later this month. This is according to the organizer of the event. The decision comes amid growing tensions between Washington and Riyadh over the decision by OPEC Plus to cut oil production by 2 million barrels a day from November. The conference, dubbed Future Investment Initiative, FII, is set to begin on October 25th in Riyadh. The three-day event usually draws top Wall Street investors, entrepreneurs, and high-ranking officials from around the world. The organizer says that the move not to invite American officials this year is made to avoid the international conference becoming a political platform. Richard Addis said that he does not want the media attention to be diverted to the political agenda between Washington and Riyadh. Independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joined us earlier for comment. He explained that the recent tensions between Riyadh and Washington are rooted in a broader dispute over Saudis shifting away from the U.S. dollar.
It was unforeseeable that the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia would change their preferences for alignments and friends as they have over the last several months. The decision to snub Biden's request for cutbacks in production is part of a broader development of policy in Saudi Arabia, and I think in particular of the shift away from the dollar, the de-dollarization of trading in oil that we see in Saudi's relationships with China.
The UK's Prime Minister apologizes to the public for her economic mistakes amid a backlash over her so-called mini-budget.
I recognize we have made mistakes. I'm sorry for those mistakes, but I've fixed the mistakes. I've appointed a new Chancellor. We have restored economic stability and fiscal discipline. And what I now want to do is go on and deliver for the public.
Truss is also insisting that she will not be stepping down and would definitely lead her party to the general election. This comes after her plan to cut tax for higher earners sent markets into turmoil and caused uproar in the parliament. Truss was forced to fire her economy minister, Kwasi Awotkan, over the proposals that were part of her so-called mini-budget. She also is facing calls to resign from within her party. Truss's new economy minister, Jeremy Hunt, now says that he will reverse almost all tax measures announced in the mini-budget. The UK is grappling with high inflation and a slow economic growth that have raised fears of a looming recession in the country. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Saeed Purez, live from London. Saeed, tell us more about this U-turn and the whole reversal of this mini-budget plan. And in many cases, when economic decisions have been made, even a U-turn won't bring back the previous situation. How hopeful are the parliamentarians in the UK that they will get back to the previous situation they were before the mini-budget?
Where do I begin, Gisu? We saw huge U-turns over the past 24 hours, adding to the ones that went previously. We heard Jeremy Hunt, the new chancellor, come out without announcement and later on meeting the MPs in Parliament in the day, ripping up, basically, the so-called mini-budget announced by his predecessor. Kwasi Kwarteng was out of the picture now, of course, co-signed by the Prime Minister, Liz Truss. We saw, for example, the corporation tax was that was not going to be risen, now will be raised. Other measures that were part of the mini-budget will also be thrown out of the window. And one, the single most expensive part of that mini-budget was the so-called energy price guarantee, whereby people wouldn't have to pay pass a certain amount to energy companies for the next 2 years. That will be revised, will be revisited in April, which means they're only helping people weather this cold winter, and let's see what happens beyond that. That does not reflect well on anyone's premiership. U-turns are always costly. We saw Liz Truss yesterday, for example, skip the brutal grilling in the House of Commons and sending in her former rival and now leader of the House of Commons, Penny Morton, to stand in for her, taking those questions one at a time. And it got to a point where she had to say that the Prime Minister was not hiding under a desk. Later on in the day, she met with what is called as the One Nation Caucus, that is a group of centrist MPs at the very center of the Conservative Party. These are moderate voices. She is hoping that she will be able to canvass, to woo these MPs to support her to stay on in power. And later on in the day, she appeared on local TV saying that she did actually make a mistake. She apologized for moving too fast with her mini budget. Like I say, these reversals are costly for any leader and is probably going to cost her as well. A couple of things that might happen as we move forward. There are calls for a general election in the meantime, or an immediate general election. That may not happen because a lot of these MPs, the Conservative MPs, are looking down the barrel of a gun, because should they go to a general election now, they're bound to lose their seats. The reason being, look at the opinion polls. The two recent ones they looked at have given Labour, the opposition Labour Party, a 32 and 36 respectively lead in the polls, meaning if there were a general election today, the Conservatives would only win 100 and Labour would probably give them a dropping by winning a 300-seat majority in Parliament. Liz Truss, of course, said yesterday that she was not going anywhere, but do we have to believe that? The reason being, Kwasi Kwarteng, the former chancellor, while in New York attending the IMF meeting, said he was not going anywhere before he cut his trip short to return here and was sacked. Jeremy Hunt, of course, the new chancellor, said that Liz Truss would still be president come Christmas. So you're looking at a very brief period between now and Christmas, whether or not she will be still standing in the next 2 years and take the Conservative Party into the 2024 general election is another question. Let's also remember that you still have the all-powerful 1922 committee of backbenchers. A lot of talk of letters of low confidence being handed over to that committee, chaired by Sarah Graham Brady. And if it gets to that point where they will receive 15%, or more than 54, because they have a 360 majority in Parliament, 54 letters of no confidence, then that will trigger a vote of no confidence. The thing is that they may not be able to do that because, according to the rules of the committee, you cannot trigger a vote of no confidence in a sitting prime minister at least 12 months into her premiership. But the thing is that it is possible that they might change the rules and cut that grace period into, let's say, 3 or 6 months and trigger that have that vote of no confidence, which will probably see Liz Truss out of power. That is assuming that she does not do so herself under immense pressure that is only piling up on her as we move forward over the ill-advised, it has to be said, mini budget that she came up with her former chancellor and now has had to backtrack on almost entirely. Gisir.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Saeed Puraza, joining us live from London. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we briefly discussed Imam Khomeini's return from Paris to Iran a few days after the Shah's escape from the country. Today, we are going to relate the story of his arrival in Iran. After 14 years of exile, Imam Khomeini arrived in Iran on February 2, 1979. The companions of Imam were very concerned and restless as they thought of the possibility of terrorist attempts or bombing plots against the Imam during the trip. Although the last prime minister of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, had agreed with the landing of the Air France flight in Tehran, there were rumors among people of a conspiracy to assassinate the Imam. Some said that the airplane would explode in the air. Others spoke of the likelihood of changing the course of the airplane and abducting the Imam. However, people in the country were looking at the sky, waiting for Imam Khomeini's flight to appear. The streets leading to Mehrabad Airport were full of millions of lovers who had gathered enthusiastically to welcome their beloved leader. Hundreds of stands were set up to distribute sweets and candies among people. Yet, the only face which was unchanged and serene was the face of Imam Khomeini, as he was sitting in the airplane in complete calm. He was so calm that when a reporter asked him of his feeling in those moments, he only answered, "Nothing." This was so amazing that the reporter didn't ask any other question. Nevertheless, the Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was very worried and preoccupied with the thought of Imam's healthy flight to Iran. She would think if the regime would let him free or would arrest and imprison him. Would the Imam's security be guaranteed during the flight? Would he be secure at the airport and his transfer from the airport to the place of his speech? Would his life be guaranteed among the swarming population in Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery? Where would be his place of residence? These and scores of other thoughts had occupied the mind of the Imam's wife. When the news of Imam Khomeini's health reached his wife in Paris, she sighed in relief and thanked God for this great bounty. After his arrival in Iran and residing at Alavi School, Imam Khomeini asked Ayatollah Mutahhari to make the preparations for his wife's return to the country. Thus, 2 days later, the lady left Paris for Tehran. In the first days, the Imam's wife was residing at a different place due to the big number of people who came to visit the Imam. At first, women were not allowed to visit the Imam. But soon, Imam Khomeini asked those in charge to determine certain days for women's visit. Therefore, The Imam and his wife could meet one another in special intervals. In view of this, many ladies, as soon as getting informed of Miss Saghafi's residence, eagerly rushed to visit her. Imam Khomeini's daughter, Zahra Mustafavi, says in this regard, "When my mother resided in this house, and the locals and other women were informed of her presence, rushed to meet her. My mother would sit on a bench, and the visitors would come in a long queue to greet and meet her. Some of them, who were closer relatives or old friends of the lady, would sit in the room for formal reception, and some of them would stay for lunch or dinner. My mother's warm welcome and smile was very memorable for all who met her." Dear listeners, on February 9th, just 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a group of the Air Force officers came to Imam Khomeini's residence as a sign of their allegiance to him. Indeed, it was as a parade before the Imam. This parade was registered by Hossein Partovi, the skilled photographer, who took the photo from the back of the officers, not to be recognized by the agents of the regime. The photo of the Air Force officers was published on Kayhan newspaper. This once more revived the hope of victory in the hearts of the people, while the puppet premier of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, was scared and panicked. When the newspaper was taken to the Imam's wife, she mentioned two important points. Firstly, the Prime Minister would no longer rely on the Air Force, and secondly, the photo was both artistic and epic. She even tried to estimate the number of the officers from the photo. The next day, a group of the Shah's special guards attacked the Air Force officers to avenge their parade. The news of this move soon was spread everywhere, and people confronted the guards till the next morning. When the Imam's wife heard the people's support for the Air Force officers, she prayed so that all events would end in victory. Thank God, the Islamic Revolution triumphed and the enemies were frustrated.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In yet another futile and hostile move, the European Union, following the footsteps of the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., have announced new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in a show of support for rioters over alleged human rights violations. Does the European Union, representing countries in the 27-member bloc, have a footing to stand on when it comes to human rights? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards at play and how this will impact the relationship between the EU and the Islamic Republic. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Batul Subeti joins us. She's a political analyst who joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Betul Subeiti. We are looking at the EU to have imposed sanctions on Iran over what they have called human rights abuses, which is alleged. They have, one segment of it has been on Iranian police and security sectors who have been working so hard to try to protect people, try to protect property, etc. And this is viewed, in one sense, if you agree, as a way to undermine the country's police and security apparatus who have been standing up to the rioters. Do you agree with that? And what do you view? What's your reaction to the EU sanctions in the first place?
Right. Yeah. So, of course, as we all know, Mahsa's tragic death sparked those widespread protests. And, you know, thousands did take to different streets demanding answers and justice for Mahsa, which is something expected. It shows that the Iranian nation is energetic and won't tolerate potential injustice. But, of course, it's also no surprise that the mobilizations turned very quickly violent. You had armed separatist groups that clashed with security forces. And as you mentioned, the security forces did what any government force is expected to do in that situation. That's to clamp down on rioters, who, of course, began to pull off the headscarves of Muslim women, setting public properties on fire. So the way that the protests morphed could never in any way, shape, or form be characterized as peaceful by the slightest. It wasn't normal. And not because of the way that the security forces dealt with it, but because of the rioters. I mean, it was led by foreign trained spies. And there's a lot of evidence of this. You know, the attacks on Iranian security forces that enabled terrorists to come out. You know, one of them was the anti-Iran terrorist Kamala group. Iranian intelligence sources also released information about how groups who are affiliated with Al-Qaeda were actually killed by the Iranian military forces in provinces like Sistan and Balochistan after they claimed responsibility for deadly attacks on police stations that killed four IRGC members. You know, the IRGC even dismantled arms trafficking gangs in places like Western Azerbaijan. So, you know, it's no secret that the West had pre-planned this. You know, whether they were going to use the title of Mahsa's death or any other title, they unleashed their undercover collaborator networks to wreak havoc in order to exert pressure on Iran in this very, very sensitive period where the nuclear negotiations are ongoing. And the West does this from time to time. It hijacks Iranian people's demands. Uh-huh. And this protest was certainly not even as large as 2019's and certainly shouldn't even compare to the scope in 2009. But in terms of the second part of your question on Europe, the sanctions that they had put, we see how Europe is actually just following the traces of America. And it does this, you know, it does this against its very own interests. So even if I give the example of confronting Russia via Ukraine.
What is their interest? What is their gain here by doing this?
Right. So there is a trajectory of Europe following America when it comes to these things. I mean, I was giving the example now of even when it comes to confronting Russia via Ukraine, the European stance against Russia has actually harmed Europe. So it's not even a case of what do they gain out of
okay.
it. They're actually harming their interests by following this
gotcha.
American trajectory in a very blind fashion.
Very well. So, you know, it's interesting, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, what our guest there, Betul Subeiti, said, because tell us the thought process as you see it when you take a look at the EU and you have certain events, incidents that are tragic in a country, which every country experiences, such as Iran, and they pick this one out. They don't listen to what Iran has provided in terms of the cause of death, and they are disregarding in the sanctions that they've imposed some of the great examples that our guests there cited about these outside groups like the Kamala that she didn't mention, but you know these are foreign-backed terrorist groups. All those are not mentioned. The killing of IRGC members, that's not mentioned. And yet they come out, they impose these sanctions, and they are portraying the Islamic Republic as a negative force in all of this. So give us your take on the whole thing.
Well, it's fundamentally a soft power war, which Europe is complicit in. It always has been. It's hidden behind, of course, the Anglo-Zionist empires, coattails. But the reality is that it is part and parcel of that. And now even more so, if we're thinking of the Europeans of having some sort of independent foreign policy, I think you could forget it, because now that they've been cornered into literally being on the front line of a war with Russia, you're going to see even less and less of an EU neutrality, as it were. And what you're seeing here is really just a manifestation of the ongoing hypocrisy of Europe and its general kind of attitude towards Iran. There is an Iranophobia. There is an Islamophobia, which is locked in systemically to European foreign policies. It's locked in systemically to their domestic policies. And the hypocrisy becomes even more apparent about what they're doing with Iran in terms of being so judgmental. And as Batul said very rightly, that they were part of an organized, orchestrated, deep state, systematic effort to change the regime, or change the government, as they'd call it, regime. Of course, that hypocrisy is exposed by the fact that Islamophobia and the attacks on Iranian property here in Europe have been pretty much allowed. I mean, there's been very little police response or protection offered for the Islamic Center of England here in London, which was attacked. We know that people have been attacked in Hamburg. There are all sorts of clear and obvious examples of Iranian MKO operatives being given a free hand, a free rein, really, to do as they like. So you can see that the hypocrisy there is there. Of course, the other hypocrisy is that Europe has a track record of stamping down very, very hard on peaceful protesters. I mean, the Yellow Jackets, for one, an example in France, where you can go and pick any number of incidents you like where the actual really militaristic French police stamped down very hard when it was necessary for them to do so. The Banlieue riots in Paris are another example. Tens of thousands of people who were marching in Belgium's capital, for instance, and in the Netherlands, and even Austria, Croatia. We've seen during the COVID-19 sure. response, when people did object, again, there was a huge stamping down and a massive a police state, if you like, draconian putting down of any opposition to the standard establishment government line. So it reeks of a hypocrisy. The Western and the European particular okay. response is totally hypocritical.
Well, you were talking about, Batul Sabeti, about the these groups that are foreign-backed, that are getting their funds and inciting acts of violence and participating in it. Now, based on what we have been provided, the EU has intentionally actually disregarded and dismissed documents that were offered by Iran. And I'm guessing that that's even as an act of goodwill, Iran providing these documents to prove foreign support for the riots. Why is the EU, do you think, then disregarding it if Iran is providing proof of it?
Right. This whole orchestrated campaign against Iran is in order to apply sanctions in the first place. So someone might ask, why sanctions now? The main aim of the sanctions now is to increase the instability and to provide the ammunition also for the rioters. I mean, even if that's on the level of providing internet, for example, you know, Elon Musk spoke about, you know, Starlink. You have tech firms that are relieving sanctions on access to apps like Zoom, for example. It begs the question of, oh, why now this is happening? It's to sustain the riots. Now, the sanctions are the riots are an excuse for the sanctions, but these sanctions are a means to an end. It's a means to pressure Iran to comply with American demands. They want a nuclear deal, but they still want sanctions on Iran. They want to have their cake and eat it. Specifically now, the US is looking to change its strategy of dealing with Iran. Since they haven't been successful through negotiations, Iran wants sanction relief. It wants robust guarantees. It wants verification. Nothing outside of the scope of the previous deal, since Iran has always been compliant, but it wants reassurances, and it has every right. And the US haven't been able to pressure Iran or to convince Iran to forego its demands when it comes to sanctions relief, verification, sequencing. And Iran has had the upper hand in the negotiations. The nuclear bar negotiations have been on a stumble block because Iran is not in a hurry to get it signed. It wants to gain the maximum out of it. So to wreak havoc internally, to get riots on the streets, is to pressure Iran. It's to use this protest movement to ask for more sanctions in hopes of even potentially sustaining its and hastening its conclusion, or to get Iran to compromise on its rights.
Sure.
Not realizing that they're actually shooting themselves in the foot and further demonstrating their lack of goodwill and intention. The whole point over here is we will discuss the US because Europe is really just an extension of US foreign policy.
I see. Okay. Well, it's interesting that you call it a protest movement. Say, Mohsen Abbas, when you take a look at whoever is out there that is rioting and breaking the law, which includes vandalism, which includes more so, not so much vandalism, but destruction of property, we're looking at these groups that are very clear in what they're chanting and what they want. And basically, they want a change in the governance of the Islamic Republic to whomever or whatever is not clear. Given that, which is clear in their chants, the EU is still supporting that, if you want to call it a movement, or those people, or those groups. Isn't that clear interference in another country's affairs?
It absolutely is a clear interference, but when have they ever not interfered in other states who are not complying with the overall, if you like, international order, as they would say. The international order, by that, they mean their masters. The masters are the money mafias that control the banking fraternity of London, Wall Street, and beyond. So Iran remains the only real state which is not within the Bank of International Settlements, isn't complying to the world order in a full and final way, and is resisting on so many levels, on a regional level, and is resisting not only militarily, but is also capable of now resisting with cyber technology. And you notice that they have actually started sanctioning the cyber efforts or the cyber capability of Iran. This is specifically because they fear Iran's capability of not only on a military level, which it's proved time and time again on the ground, but they're also now going to fear that Iran will recognize that it needs a really powerful soft power response. You need an equally powerful way of being able to resist the propaganda, the deep state kind of psychological operations, the rollout of all of these kind of color revolution efforts. There needs to be a much stronger content and substance, which will help to educate not only the Islamic Republic of Iran and its own population, but also the world at large, because we're now living in a world where huge changes during this great reset, which Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and others are pushing. Now, Iran is not totally part of that. And one of the examples I'll give is that Ayatollah Khamenei very wisely resisted the Agenda 2030, for instance, the UN Sustainable Goals role. Now, that's just couched language for depopulation, for LGBT agendas, for more hedonism, more liberalism, and more control of the agricultures and the industries of the so-called poorer nations. Now, Iran has very strongly resisted that, and I think that these things all make sure that Iran is enemy number one. So Iranophobia is not an accident. It's something that's whipped up, whether it's Netanyahu when he was showing his little childish graphs about why they should bomb Iran's nuclear plants, or whether it's Donald Trump trying to assassinate a diplomatic mission with Haji Qasem Soleimani. All of these actions are basically desperation. Their desperation of the money mafia, their desperation of Israel, which is their favorite pet in the world and specifically in West Asia. And the Europeans are basically a paper tiger that wags. It's a tail. It wags every time the Atlantic, if you like, real powers, the Americans and the Zionists that control them, actually tell them to jump. Look, for instance, German exports to the U.S. are worth $110 billion. per month. That's one quote I've had in 2017. I mean, it sold $3 billion to Iran at that time. So you can see there was a no-brainer in terms of Europe going the way of the Americans and doing as they're told. And now that the Russians are squeezing the energy aspect of it and of their lifeline, you can see that all of these nations will fall even more in line with the Americans, and they're not going to let up in terms of trying to see a JCPOA or a nuclear agreement which really works in the long run. And Iran has already started shifting his attention very rapidly to China, Russia, and the Eurasian axis with the Shanghai Cooperation, etc., and very rightly so.
Yeah, we only have 5 minutes left. So many angles to cover over here. I got to squeeze this one in between what both have said. It's kind of not along those lines, but again, it gives another dimension to this. And I'd like to ask you, Tosfa Beti, about how the EU has insisted that Iran has been involved in the Ukraine conflict by sending military equipment to Russia. Now, this has come despite frequent denials, again, in relation to the sanctions that have been leveled against Iran by the EU. Now, the quick question that comes about is, why would they do that when they themselves have provided countries like France, the UK, and Germany, for example, have provided weapons to Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war on Yemen, which has killed so many innocent civilians?
Right, exactly. So the whole, I guess, this whole war that is being launched is really just one of consolidating American hegemony. America is threatened by the unipolar nature of the world in which it is dominating, but it actually doesn't realize how this whole campaign against Russia, against China, against Iran is very, very counterproductive for the West, because the opposing camp that is actually bearing the brunt of Western hegemony and sanctions is forming stronger alliances. You know, the US is increasing the list of countries that they are opposed to, and these entities are getting stronger, and they will seek to break the hegemony of the dollar through building those parallel systems and those parallel alliances, whether it's the Shanghai Cooperation Council, the Shanghai Cooperation, whether it's BRICS, and this new world order is being formed, including Russia, China, Iran, that are key players. It is a multipolar world and will therefore balance out the American fist. I think by now the hypocrisy is clear for everyone to see, right? And the decision that Russia took has to be seen.
How do you deliver? How do you deliver that message? As you said, the hypocrisy that is evident to see. How do you deliver that message across the world?
I mean, the hypocrisy is clear on every single level. I mean, the biggest form of tyranny is the propaganda machine. You know, if the West truly cares about freedom, for example, those 275 million tweets that we saw about Mahsa Amini would be against Western sanctions that killed thousands of vulnerable women and children. We would see those 275 million tweets, for example, against the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have elections, and it's only enabled to carry out crimes of the highest order due to the protection that it receives from the West as its client state. We would see record-breaking tweets, for example, for the Muslim women that are forced to unveil in supposed enlightened secular societies like France, indeed, you know, that are supposed to protect religious freedoms, let alone singling out Muslim targets.
So why doesn't that happen, say, Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Palestinians, for example? Why does the EU, first of all, come out, and it's supposed to be part of the Mideast Quartet, come to think of it, but they only come out and condemn. But why isn't there a massive tweet storm against what Israel is doing against Palestinians?
Because all of these social media sites, most of the Western media outlets, whether they're television, social media, Twitter, Facebook, name them all, whichever one you want to turn to, ultimately the hand and the finance and the people that control it in the background are all part of one very powerful neoliberal, neoconservative ideology. And what they've done, what they're doing today is not something that's happened overnight. This is something that they planned at the turn of the century. They said very clearly the American military was going to knock out seven nations. Out of that, they pretty much done it to everybody except Iran and Venezuela. I think they're the only ones left out of that system. So you're faced with a pre-planned, premeditated, absolutely calculated attack by the most powerful forces in this world, and they have an ideological problem with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's not forget that. Imam Khomeini set up an establishment here which has some moral values, and it has a dream. It has an Islamic dream. Whether it's being able to achieve it, absolutely not. They're certainly not allowing it to achieve that dream in the way that perhaps he would have envisaged. But nonetheless, that war, that ideological war, is real, is existential. You see, once you have an ideology like neoliberalism, which wants narcissism, which wants hedonism, which wants to promote all of this kind of slavery of a new kind to the world, you have to have a thinking, an ideology, a kind of a dream which opposes that. The Islamic dream that Iran has been given. At the heart of it, Imam Khamenei has fully embraced that,
right.
And I hear it in all of his speeches. He's very smart, big wise, okay. Knows exactly what he's saying, and he is consciously opposing that
sure.
Hedonism, that kind of very, very evil kind of ideology that's coming from these forces.
Okay, final question about Thulsebedi. I told you time is running out quickly, so I give you a minute on this. Is what kind of response should Iran give, which is proportionate and reciprocal when it comes to the EU sanctions, and how do you think that response should be given?
Right. So I think sanctions on entities and individuals in Iran have existed for 40 years. It doesn't affect Iran at this point. Iran has managed to create a resistance economy out of it on every single level, from manufacturing to agriculture to scientific growth. Sanctions have actually backfired. So in a way, when Europe sanctions Iran, Iran turns those problems into opportunities, and it figures out a way that it can actually grow itself out of it. So it's not expected that these sanctions from the Europeans would affect Iran. What I would say is these sanctions are actually affecting relations, because it shows Europe is unreliable. It shows that they don't stick to their pledges. So it's actually harming Europe's reputation and Europe's stance more than it can ever harm Iran.
Thank you so much, Betul Sebedi, political analyst. Said Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavli, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So facing the opponents in a religion is a controversial topic. In fact, we have some people who inside the religion of Islam or from outside are opposing some of the beliefs. How to, we can say, react towards such an action or such behaviors in the religion of Islam? Sheikh, what's your answer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very significant question because of the fact that nowadays we see many people suffering from this problem. By suffering, I mean that they have such a problem in dealing with the people who do not think like them. And as Muslims, unfortunately, many of them, they are not able to practice Islamic instructions as mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. So nowadays we see Muslims having problem with their non-Muslim neighbors, friends, and so on and so forth, as followers of different Islamic denominations, Shia, Sunni, and other Islamic denominations, they cannot tolerate each other, at least in some parts of the world. But the point is that if we act upon the verses of the Quran and the seerah, the lifestyle of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, we see that this is not the case. Let's just begin by a verse from chapter An-Nahl, verse 125. Of course, mainly I would like to talk about theoretical discussions between the followers of different religions and denominations, and then I may go to some practical points as well. So Allah says that Udu ala sabila rabbika bil hikmati wal maw'izati al hasana, invite to the way of your Lord with wisdom and good advice. وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنٌ. So first of all, we are talking about hikmah, wisdom, and الْمَوْعِذَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ, good advice. Are we acting upon that? Good advice is a very important feature of any kind of advice. We are, in many cases, asking the people, commanding the people, but it cannot be considered as a good advice. Even when you're talking about enjoining good and forbidding the evil, is the way, is the content a good one or not? This is a very important issue.
Okay.
And then even if you're going to dispute, وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنٌ, and dispute with them in a manner that is best. Practically speaking, when we refer to the lifestyle of the Prophet and infallible Imams, we see that in some cases, for example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he has many debates with atheists, with people without any religion, or with people who believed in two gods. They were dualists.
Dualists, that's right.
Yeah, for example, the stories of Ibn Abil Awja, Abu Shakir, Daysani, Ja'd ibn Darham, and all of them were welcomed by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, there is a very interesting point, and that is the fact is that we do not read in the history that in many cases they accepted the religion of Islam. No, they continued to be atheists, but still Imam Sadiq alayhi salam welcomed them.
That's right, and answered the questions.
And answered the questions. Okay. So I believe this is the way that we need to put as a kind of role model, as a kind of symbol.
And there is a very good manner, ethical and moral, we can say, how can I say, merits in such actions from the side of our Imams and Prophet Muhammad, something which is we call it tolerance, you know.
Exactly.
And the rate of tolerance today, you know, especially in the world, is really low, not only in the religious communities, but in non-religious ones, the people cannot, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if we can imagine that nowadays different leaders of different religions come together, just sit together, discuss different issues. But Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, not only he's talking to the leaders of other religions, he talks to atheists. Mm-hmm. So can we imagine that today an Islamic leader comes and sits with a leader in atheism, for example, one of the famous atheists. So this is what we are in need of, and this is what the religion of Islam is inviting to.
Okay.
And when it comes to different followers of different Islamic denominations, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had discussions with Abu Hanifa, for example, mm-hmm. according to some historical accounts. And we know that he was one of the imams and leaders Sunnis.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IR.